talk about the next steps in the project, and then at the end we'll have time for a few questions. So in the spring of 2011, the Food Bank Coalition of San Luis Obispo County received one of 10 USDA Hunger Free Communities planning grants. Under this grant, there were three main projects. The first one was to create a local food policy council, which has been named the SLO County Food System Coalition. And this is a group of diverse food system stakeholders, which I'll talk about in more detail later. The second component of this grant was to conduct three assessments to examine food resources, food security, and nutritional need in San Luis Obispo County. The Central Coast Ag Network put together a food resources guide, and Cal Poly Stride conducted a food store survey and a food security survey. And the third component of this grant, the piece I worked on, was to create a hunger-free community plan for San Luis Obispo County. Throughout this project, many people have asked me what hunger has to do with city planning, since I was a planning student. And to begin this discussion, let me first explain what a food system is. A food system can be described as the chain of activities connecting food production, processing, distribution, consumption, waste management, as well as all the associated regulatory institutions and activities. Throughout this system, food takes many paths that have ramifications upon our natural, social, and economic environments. A prevalence of hunger is one indication that inefficiencies and shortcomings exist in the food system. And so to sufficiently address hunger here in San Luis Obispo County, a holistic examination of the county's food system was conducted. Now, to get back to how this relates to planning. In 1997, the Association of Collegiate Schools of Planning identified six themes that anchored the planning discipline. One of these themes was a focus on improvement of human settlements, with emphasis on making places better serve the needs of people. At this time, two planning academics came together to assert that air, water, and food are the three essentials of life, and that any quality human settlement needs sufficient access to these three resources. They noted that while planners have been involved with air and water issues for some time, food has virtually been ignored. They spent the next decade working to bring food systems to the planning agenda. And as they argue, the food system is inextricably linked to many other urban systems and planning concerns. For example, land use affects how much land is available for food production, where food is produced, where it is sold, and how close it is to where residents live. Transportation networks dictate how food is transported from where it is produced to where it is sold, and how consumers reach their food. Public transportation systems can be a large factor in food access for residents without cars. The food system offers employment throughout all systems of the food system and makes a significant contribution to a city's economy. And the affordability of housing may affect one's ability to purchase food. The American Planning Association has since recognized food systems planning as a field within the planning profession, and in 2007 adopted a policy guide on community and regional food planning. So now I'll discuss some of the things we learned about hunger specific to San Luis Obispo County. Our research questions included, who is hungry or food insecure in SLO County? What are the primary barriers to food access? What is the state of local food production? How nutritious is the food being consumed by residents? And what resources and services currently exist to address food security and nutrition? Some of our key takeaways include, first of all, that there's low participation in food assistance programs. SLO County ranks 53rd out of 58 counties in California for CalFresh participation, with only about 29% of income-eligible individuals participating in this program. Second, we know that there's a surplus of food grown here, but it cannot get adequately distributed. Enough is produced to feed every resident 7.5 pounds of fruits and vegetables a day, but most of this does not stay within the county. Third, children are disproportionately affected. Children make up about 19% of the county's population, but close to 40% of food bank clients. We also learned that there's a high number of residents that face choosing between buying food and paying rent, medical expenses, and other bills. We learned that healthier foods are more expensive and harder to find than snack foods. We know that the food bank has seen a 40% increase in the number of people needing their services in the past 2 years. And almost 50% of adults are overweight or obese in San Luis Obispo County, and 40% of children are overweight or at risk of becoming overweight. There is a high correlation between obesity and hunger, and as such, this plan prioritizes nutrition. So now I'll give a brief summary of each of the five elements of the plan, starting with access to sufficient food. And the goal is that all San Luis Obispo County residents have access to nutritious food. Issues of hunger and poor nutrition have been clearly linked to limited access to fresh, affordable food. Food bank distributions, federal nutrition assistance programs, and schools all play a role in food access for low-income residents. In addition, funding for these different programs is addressed. The second component of the plan looks at nutrition and hunger, with the goal of improved nutrition of San Luis Obispo County residents who experience food insecurity. One's food choices have a great effect on overall health. Therefore, it is not just the quantity of food we are concerned about, but the quality of food. Increasing the availability of nutritious food, prioritizing healthy and local food, nutrition education and outreach, and access to healthy food retail are all ways to reach this goal. The third component of the plan examines the local food system, and the goal is a sustainable local food system that is able to meet the food needs of SLO County residents. As you all know, San Luis Obispo is an agriculturally rich place, with 65% of the county made up of agricultural land. However, most of this food leaves the county. Increased investments in local agriculture and fishing can help reconnect a community with healthy foods while supporting small farmers, ranchers, and fishers. Objectives aim to increase opportunities for local food processing, distribution, marketing, and sales, enhance gleaning efforts, promote agriculture as an economic development tool, and protect food production resources. In order to end hunger, efforts must extend beyond the emergency food net and address the root causes of hunger. Our goal is collaborative community efforts to address the root causes of hunger in San Luis Obispo County. There is a large correlation between those living in poverty and those who are food insecure. Those struggling to sufficiently feed themselves and their families are often struggling to provide themselves with other basic resources such as housing and health care. The local job market, coupled with high cost of living, aggravates the hunger situation in San Luis Obispo County. Expanding access to low-cost health care, increasing the number of livable wage jobs, and making affordable housing and transportation more available can all help to increase food security. And the last component of this plan looks at the SLO County Food System Coalition and the role they play. The SLO County Food System Coalition, again, is a diverse group of food system stakeholders, which includes representatives from agriculture, public health and nutrition, environmental groups, schools, county government, and social service agencies. Its mission is to promote a sustainable food system that is equitable, profitable, resilient, and health-promoting in the county of San Luis Obispo. The coalition played an active role in creating this plan, and our goal is a vibrant SLO County Food System Coalition and effective hunger-free community plan. Objectives in this section are to strengthen the coalition through an engaged membership and by maintaining alliances with local, state, and national organizations, to establish an advocacy committee, and to review the plan on an annual basis. This plan aims to be feasible and measurable. Indicators have been identified for each strategy to measure success over time. In addition, each strategy has been designated as initial, medium, or long-term. And there is a lead agency or agencies responsible for implementation of each strategy. Many strategies in this plan involve land use, transportation, affordable housing, ag land preservation, and economic development. These are just a few examples of the planning-related strategies found in the plan. This plan was adopted by the Food System Coalition in June of 2012. We have presented the plan to local commissions, organizations, agencies, and individuals for endorsement to build community support around the plan. Next week, we will present the plan to the County Board of Supervisors and then continue to implement the plan and review it on an annual basis. Thank you. Are there any questions?
Commissioner Christensen.
Yes, thank you very much. That was quite interesting. I actually had a question about one of your initial conclusions that you presented, the one that healthy foods are more expensive than snack foods.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering how you came up with that because, I've done a lot of reading, and that apparently is kind of a myth. In other words, if I took $10 and tried to buy, like, some chicken and some mm-hmm. potatoes and broccoli and apples, I could get quite a ways further than if I bought, like, potato chips.
That finding came from Stride's food store survey, and what the Stride team did was they surveyed over 50 grocery stores in the county and went around and looked at, they had a sample shopping list for each store and went through and kind of assessed this shopping list, and that was
would be most helpful over a period of the next 4 years.
Carl, do you?
Yeah.
I'm Carl Hansen, the executive director of the Food Bank Coalition. I think, the Food System Coalition does not conceive of itself as anything but a forum to bring together the thinkers and the doers in our county from all sorts of perspectives and hopefully vet a lot of the concerns that were addressed in the surveys and in the strategic plan, and be supportive of the work that you do in terms of taking this already heavily discussed and researched information, disagreeing with it, agreeing with it, and helping it move forward toward a better, healthier community. So you would be probably in the role of someone that we would want to come to before we went to the Board of Supervisors, for example, to have you help us examine the results of wherever we are. And that's kind of why we're here today. Although there is a lot of advocacy that goes on in food policy councils, we belong to the statewide food policy council of councils, if you will, which does mostly advocacy work, which all nonprofits do in one way or another, because the issue is bigger than what we do in our county. And our role here would be to advocate for a healthier food system and a more adequate food system to feed our own and not have to depend on going outside the county, which is not environmentally good or economically reasonable, and be able to function more self-reliant as a county and depend upon our own resources for our own good health as a community. So you are right at the core of that process, and that's why we want you to be informed. We want you to give meaningful feedback to us and to the Board of Supervisors. And as these agendas get moved forward, we hope to be a tremendous resource because we have literally had at the table farmers and environmentalists, the Farm Bureau and the Sierra Club, businesses, nonprofits, government representatives from the health department, education people, and very actively working together on this planning process. And now we're at the stage of implementing this plan, which will be largely through the resources of the food bank, but certainly not without the support of the community, because we would come to a dead halt if we didn't have that. So I hope that's helpful.
I note that coincidentally there are several items on our consent agenda this morning that have to do with agricultural land preserves, so we are involved in one of the balloons on your presentation. So
yes.
We also have on our agenda the affordable housing ordinance, and I suspect that has a good bit of
right.
bearing.
Yeah.
Commissioner Murphy?
Perfect lead-in. That was excellent. One of my concerns is some of the measures or goals or major goals of the project is to put more people, let's say, on public assistance or CalFresh or health. yet the root cause of hunger is pointed out to be poverty, essentially, and that's going back to what Commissioner Topping brought up. And that's sort of as far as your advocacy. I'd like to see you definitely work towards this idea of living wages and affordable housing, and that's something that the economic vitality of our county is ultimately what's going to solve our hunger problem, and that's something that needs to be heard at our meetings and Board of Supervisor meetings when we're looking at many of the regulations regarding inclusionary housing or whatever other new rules or restrictions we might be implementing, the effect on the economy of our county, the effect that has on our residents, and thereby increasing the amount of hunger. And that ultimately is the cure for hunger. We're treating it.
Right.
What we're doing is treating the problem, but the ultimate cure is to where people can afford to purchase or grow their own food. So I just want to point that out. That part of your plan, I think, needs to be one of the advocacy you do is for let's make it affordable to live in our county and let's have good jobs where people can afford to buy their food that they don't have to go through one of our assistance programs. But the program, overall, I think the concept's good. My background's in agriculture. I know a lot of the farmers definitely participate in your programs. Gleaning is an excellent way to go. There's some of the labor shortages. There's getting to be more food available in the fields than there used to be. So all in all, I think it's good. But I think keep that part of your advocacy in mind going forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've expressed to be able to have meaningful, positive researched and agreed upon a consensus, at least, among the varied players that are involved, the stakeholders in our community.
Well, thank you, Mr. Hansen and Ms. Cadigan and Ms. Carley, for a most informative presentation. Yes, Mr. Stevens.
Thank you. And I just wanted to sort of tag on to Carl Hansen's comment and sort of answer your questions about how your commission can be involved in helping to implement some of this. As you know, HealSLO has received status as a referral agency for the health commission. And they're providing comments to your commission on certain land use applications that come before you. They'll also be providing comments on general plan policies or community plan updates. And so where some of these strategies may be appropriate to fit in the context of those discussions, that group will be providing comments to your referral comments. So this is something that this is not part of the general plan, and it is a standalone report, but it certainly has very important strategies and guidelines for enhancing our local food system. So those recommendations will be coming to you through that venue.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Orton, a couple of procedural things. Do I need to ask for speaker slips? And do I need to open this item to public comment?
I think it should be open for public comment.
Okay.
You don't need speaker slips.
And okay. I would just add there's no action required for your commission on this item.
Got it. I see Commissioner Topping has his light on. Did you have another question or comment?
Can we endorse it if we want to?
Have at it.
It's not required, but that would seem to be a logical thing for us to do. And I guess I'm curious about food production in residential areas in the sense of restrictions that we may be imposing mm-hmm. on that. I know that animal keeping is part of food production for part of the community. Were there any comments or directions that might lead to modifications of our animal keeping or gardening? Are there any restrictions that we may be imposing at this time through the zoning ordinance that may be somewhat dated?
Well, we could certainly look at those. Generally speaking, home gardening is allowed, keeping of, not roosters, not noisy animals or large animals, but certainly small, a few chickens in some category areas is fine. It's mostly based on public health and safety and nuisance, where there might be odors or noise as generated from those uses. It can be a problem, but otherwise some activity is allowed in residential areas.
Okay, I'd like to open this item to public comment. If anyone would like to speak on the item that we just heard, please come to the podium. Seeing no one approaching, I will close public comment. Okay.
Commissioner Topping, did you have anything further in mind about this?
I have a motion.
Please proceed.
Okay. Well, as a proud affiliate of Cal Poly, I'd like to, as a sometime supporter of the food bank, I'd like to suggest that we endorse this plan and also recommend to the Board of Supervisors that we have periodic reports on whether we're gaining on it or not, like on maybe an annual basis or biannual basis, something like that.
Okay, so that's a motion you're making.
That's a motion.
Is that correct? And
yes.
That would require a second.
I'll second it.
Okay, thank you. Any discussion on this motion? Hearing none, Ramona, please call the roll.
Commissioner Topping?
Yes.
Commissioner Murphy?
Yes.
Commissioner Christensen?
Aye.
Chairman O'Grady?
Yes, motion passes 4-0. Thank you very much. Okay, the next item on the agenda is our consent agenda, and there are several items that have to do with the ag preserves. I think those are items A through G, and then there's items H through I that are minutes. Does anyone, commissioner or from the public, wish to pull any of these items for discussion? Well, I would like to pull A through G because I have a couple questions on that. So let's first deal with the minutes. May I have a motion to approve the minutes as presented?
So moved. They come before you in case you have items of special concern or want to contribute to the recommendation that goes on to the Board of Supervisors. The primary reviewing body is the Agricultural Preserve Review Committee, which, of course, sees all of these and makes their formal recommendation prior to these coming to you for consent.
Okay. Is this a prelude to applicants entering into Williamson Act contracts?
Yes, it is. It's basically a two-step process. Agricultural preserves are a legislative act, and they're like kind of like zoning. They require action by the Board of Supervisors at a public hearing. Mm-hmm. And once the agricultural preserve is established, they may or may not end up entering into a contract. Generally, they do. Generally, they go forward with a contract. We do have some properties that are in agricultural preserve but not in contract. Typically, the purpose of applying for an application to go into an agricultural preserve is so that they may enter into a contract.
So. Okay. But if they don't continue on to enter into a contract, how does that benefit the county?
Well, basically, there would not be any property tax implications of simply being in an agricultural preserve. It's only when they enter into a land conservation contract that there's property tax implications.
Okay. Are there any other implications?
Typically, if you enter into an agricultural preserve and you want to change your land use designation for some other reason, like many years later, typically plans change and a family might want to do a general plan amendment, and in that case, they would have to establish the agricultural preserve to be able to do a general plan amendment to change it to, say, rural lands or residential rural.
Okay, but the words agricultural preserve, I mean, do they literally mean what that says? I mean, that the land under that we're approving to go under this contract is preserved for ag?
It's preserved for agricultural use, typically, there are some other types of agricultural preserves, which we actually have an example of one today, and that is wildlife habitat. We also do those, and this is actually in the state act, and it's also reflected in our rules of procedure. It's a process and an application type that is available for landowners that qualify.
Okay. You mentioned property tax implication. That's reduction in property taxes for applicants who become included under a Williamson Act contract. Is that correct? So, if I recall, the county used to be reimbursed by the state for shortfalls in property taxes due to Williamson Act contracts, but that's not so anymore. Is that correct?
They have withdrawn their support, and they have stopped providing subvention funds to the counties throughout the state of California.
So there's cost to the county implicit in our approval of items A through G, and can you give us an order of magnitude of what we're talking about?
Certainly. The assessor's office provides that information for us, and they did an estimate that's in the memo that I provided to you earlier. But that amount is the total estimated annual reduction in property taxes for all of the seven properties combined on the consent agenda is $32,715.
Per year?
Per year. That's an annual basis.
And these are, what, 10, 20-year contracts, something like that?
Most of these are 20 years, yes.
Yeah. Okay, I think maybe I have one other question. Well, one I recall was had to do with grazing and how that may or may not be compatible with agricultural preserves and habitat preservation and agricultural crop land preservation. Can you address that?
Was there a specific one you wanted to look at, or out of all of the seven, or is that a general question?
That was a general question.
Okay. Typically, our rangeland properties offer some habitat value. It depends on each individual case. We have, you know, of course, not all of a 100-acre ranch may be suitable for grazing. There's areas that are quite steep, for example, inaccessible to the cattle. There's also dense oak woodland, dense chaparral. There may be riparian areas. Quite typically, there are all of those things in the larger ranches along the coast and also inland. And so really, without it being formalized, I guess you could say, the grazing land agricultural preserves also offer habitat value for many of our local species, plant and animal.
Okay. And so this has been looked at by Fish and Game already? I thought I saw a letter in there.
Well, there is an item on your on the consent agenda, and we actually had a request from the applicant. And if you'd like to talk about that one specifically, maybe now is the time to provide a connection between the Carissa and Camp Roberts that far away. So apparently there's a fair amount of migration going along that corridor, and this is a large property and will offer value to those migratory species.
Okay, I notice on page D6 of the staff report, that's item D, and that one is applicant Jorian Clark established an agricultural preserve based on protection of open space, wildlife habitat. And Mr. Sparling from the Agricultural Preserve Review Committee voted no on that particular item, and his reason for doing so was that he didn't feel like compensation to landowners in the form of the reduced property taxes that you mentioned. He felt that it should be limited to compensation for productive agricultural lands and not open space. And so that leads me to wonder if staff evaluates or makes value judgments about the amount of reduced income to the county on these particular items. If there's a commensurate benefit with the cost to the county, or whether if they fit the profile for the contract that the staff just approves it, regardless of what the financial implications might be to the county.
At the staff level, we actually review the eligibility criteria.
Okay.
We're aware of these considerations, and they're discussed on a, you know, on a program basis, I guess you could say. But in terms of evaluating individual projects, we don't use that as a criteria basis. We don't say, well, if you get this much property tax relief, that's too much, and we're going to recommend denial. We don't approach it that way at all. That doesn't even enter into it. We have eligibility criteria that we follow. I would say that when we go to the Board of Supervisors, we provide the financial information for the whole batch of applications that are going to the Board at public hearing, and the Board of Supervisors certainly considers that. So I think it's more of a higher level, program-based question, not one that we apply to individual reviews of individual applications.
Okay.
Well, the $320,000 over 10 years got my attention.
It's $32,000, actually.
It's what?
$32,000.
$32,000 per year.
Yeah.
So 10 years.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
The
total contract, or double that for 20 years. So
right.
Anyway, I'm interested. Commissioner Murphy, you have your light on to speak to this item.
Yeah, you made me think of another question. Not the other question. Actually, my question had to do with the process. These are ag preserve. It's going for the Board of Supervisors preserve, ag preserve. What's the process to actually go into the Williamson contract? Is that got to be approved by the Board of Supervisors also?
It does, but it's approved at the consent level. And so after we establish agricultural preserves, or actually when the board does, then I prepare land conservation contracts, and they go out to the applicants. The applicants have them signed and notarized. They come back and get a review by county council for form and effect and proper execution, and then they're packaged up and sent to the board on consent. And then they formally enter into the contract, and the contract is recorded through that end of the process.
Okay, so the real deliberation is done at this establishing the preserve levels when they really look at whether or not they want to proceed. And once they approve the preserve, the idea is they will do a contract.
The Board of Supervisors?
Yeah, the board level.
Right. If there were concerns about eligibility for a particular item on the agenda, that's where it would be discussed at the public hearing during the discretionary review process.
Okay. Well, excuse me.
I was just going to say, since the board is responsible for the budget, then I'm glad to hear that they will have the financial figures at their disposal so that they may consider that. So, but I would like the minutes to show Ramona that I encourage the board to consider the financial implications of these particular items. Mr. Orton.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to add with regard to the Clark item number D, there's a revised finding A that actually designates the wildlife habitat areas required by the code. And so I think Terry has already passed that out.
Okay, so we'll...
I just wanted to make that part of the record.
That becomes part of the record, yep. Then. Okay, thank you.
And while we're at that, Mr. Chairman, if I might, I also passed out a revised exhibit because Ms. Clark has two legal parcels, and just this week, just a couple of days ago, she actually sent us a letter, which is also in your package, and she's requested that she put the large parcel in so it be continue forward and be continue to be part of her application. But the small 40-acre parcel, which is not critical to the eligibility of
row.
Commissioner Christensen?
I was thinking 87. Sorry.
Commissioner Copping?
Yes.
Commissioner Murphy?
Yes.
Chairman O'Grady?
Yes. Motion passes 4-0. Thank you, Mr. Waller. Okay. That takes care of the consent agenda. That moves us to hearing item number 2. Ramona, would you please introduce that particular item?
Hearing to consider a request by the Los Osos Community Services District to amend Development Plan Coastal Development Permit, DRC 2007-00181. County file number DRC 2010-00008, Supervisorial District Number 2, Carrie Brown, Project Manager.
Okay, before I ask Ms. Brown to proceed, I'd like to ask if there's any ex parte to report by commissioners on this particular item. Hearing none, good morning, Ms. Brown.
Good morning, Planning Commissioners. Carrie Brown, County Planning Staff. The Los Osos Community Services District is proposing a nitrate removal system for an existing community well. It is located off of Napomo Avenue in South Bay in the community of Los Osos. It is in the residential suburban land use category. Here is an aerial of the site. Just to start out with some background information, the community of Los Osos draws its drinking water solely from the Los Osos groundwater basin. The community currently has no wastewater collection and treatment system, but relies on septic systems. The basin is made up of an upper aquifer and a lower aquifer. the upper aquifer has high levels of nitrate due to the influence of septic systems. The lower aquifer, which supplies the bulk of the water for the community, is in a state of overdraft and experiencing the effects of seawater intrusion. In March 2007, the County of San Luis Obispo certified a level 3 severity for water resources within the basin. Level 3 occurs when the capacity of the groundwater basin has been met or exceeded, and there's a deficiency of sufficient magnitude that drastic actions may be needed to protect public health and safety. On August 14, 2008, the Planning Commission approved a domestic shallow aquifer well. This new well was proposed to be blended and treated with the existing lower aquifer well prior to the introduction to the water supply system. The new well was to provide added reliability to the existing water supply system and reduce dependency on withdrawals of the lower aquifer water. During the well construction, nitrates leaked into the lower aquifer. This made the blended nitrate level too high, resulting in the inability to use the new upper aquifer well for domestic purposes. The Los Osos Community Services District wants to install a nitrate removal system so that they can use this water well for the community. Here is a site plan of the nitrate removal system. It's a small building and a small water tank for brine disposal. Here's kind of a plan view of the site. Recently, Julie Vanderweer with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has contacted the Planning Department regarding the site and the history and presence of Morro Shoulder Band snails. In 2006-2007, Morro Shoulder Band snails were found at the site. Minimization and avoidance measures were implemented as part of the previous project. Last winter, a habitat assessment for Morro Shoulder Band snail was conducted, and no snails or shells were found. However, the results of the survey were not submitted to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which is standard practice. To address this issue and the service's concerns, staff is proposing a new condition, and that would be new condition number 10. I'll read it to you. Prior to issuance of a notice to proceed, the applicant shall obtain a letter of concurrence from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that the proposed project will not result in take of the federally endangered Morro Shoulder Band snail. And with that, staff is recommending that the Planning Commission consider and rely on the previously approved mitigated negative declaration adopted on June 8, 2012, prepared by the Los Osos Community Services District acting as lead agency, and approve the development plan. And this concludes my presentation.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Brown. That new condition 10.
Minimize seawater intrusion in the community. We did understand the new condition and are supportive of it, and we encourage your commission to act today, and we're excited about our grant opportunity. I'd be happy to answer any technical questions on the engineering nature of the project as well. We do actually have our board president, Marshall Hilsky, and our general manager, Susan Morrow, also here today with us.
Thank you. I'll have a couple technical questions later for you.
Okay. Great. Looking forward to it.
All right. Okay. Commissioner Topping, I see you had your light on.
Yeah, only to say that I'm familiar with the site. And
Is your speaker...
Only to say that I'm familiar with the site, and it's a very straightforward application.
Okay. I'd like to open the item for public comment at this time. Does anyone wish to come forward to speak on this particular item? Oh, and Mr. Miller, if you would please fill out a speaker slip.
Mr. Miller has already.
Good.
Thank you.
Where is it?
It's over in the box.
Okay.
As great. Well as the other speaker behind me.
Okay.
Good morning. My name is Susan Morrow. This is the first time I've been able to address this commission. I am the new general manager to the Los Osos Community Services District. I just wanted to talk about the ion exchange program, which is also called denitrification. We're requesting in this application a 168-square-foot building with a 5,000 tank for the brine and ionization equipment to remove nitrates for this existing well on this site, which is county right-of-way. The well cannot be used, as Ms. Brown had indicated, because of the nitrate content. And this application will allow the district to remove the nitrates, blend the water with the lower aquifer, and make it usable and potable water. As you know, we are on groundwater only, and it will be too cost restrictive to be able to import water. This is an opportunity to operate a nitrate system removal system on a small but a significant scale. I just wanted to say that this was unanimously approved through LOCAC when I did a presentation there. It's essential to the Los Osos residents and businesses, and I appreciate your support, and I will leave the technical questions to my district engineer. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Morrow. I have a speaker slip from Marshall Ohilski.
Good morning, Chair and Commissioners.
Good morning.
I'm Marshall Ohilski, the President of the Los Osos CSD Board of Directors. I just wanted to say that my board did approve the environmental documentation determination on this unanimously. We have supported this from the time we applied for the grant money. We do have a serious seawater intrusion issue, and it's a really just a small step towards addressing that, but I think every little bit helps.
Sure.
So, and we do have grant money waiting to be awarded on this, so we're hopeful that we'll get the Planning Commission seal of approval and move forward on that. I can't answer any technical questions, but if you have any political questions,
I promise I won't ask you any.
But anyways, we would request your support on this matter. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ohilski. That's my last speaker slip. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak on this item? Seeing no one, I will close public comment and bring it back to the commission. Commissioner Topping. You are the commissioner from the district, so you may ask your questions first.
I have no questions whatsoever. I fully sympathize with the district and wish them well on this project.
All right. Commissioner Murphy.
Somebody, real quick, how does it...
Your microphone.
I'm just curious if you're drilling a well into the upper aquifer, how you pollute the lower aquifer. Is that the same occurrence, or was these two separate occurrences?
They already drilled the well for the lower aquifer. When they, you know, after they drilled it, they found that it was contaminated with nitrates, and so this nitrate removal system would be used on the existing well at the site.
The way I read it, they were attempting to drill a well into the upper aquifer, and in the process of doing that, contaminated the lower aquifer. Is that not correct?
No.
Maybe we can ask the engineer standing behind you.
Sure. And Rob Miller, district engineer. It wasn't a contamination resulting from the drilling of the upper aquifer well because it doesn't go deep enough.
Okay.
It was the period of time, a couple of years, when the lower aquifer well was not used that the plume of nitrogen from the upper aquifer finds the old borehole for the deeper well and slowly migrates down. It's actually not the first time this has happened in the community. Some other lower aquifer wells that have been dormant for a period of time have seen that type of contamination as well. It does slowly degrade over time, but it's been very slow as we produced from that lower well over the last few years. We see a trend, but it's going to take a long time to...
I have a few... Mr. Miller, where did you go? There you are. About that old and unused well, has that stopped... Did I understand you to say it stopped contaminating the aquifer because it just did it on its own? It just stopped? It ran dry? How did that happen?
It was the lack of use of the well that resulted in the leakage from upper to lower and the nitrate contamination. That well has since been brought back online, and we're actively producing from it as we speak, and that is what has resulted in the downward trend.
Okay, and maybe this is for Ms. Brown, maybe for you, I'm not sure. On page 2-3 of the staff report, it says the nitrate removal system will work in conjunction with the existing upper aquifer well. But then, on page item C2, says that it's a new well. So could you review the wells that are involved, what's existing, what's new, and how?
Sure.
Okay.
There are two wells on the property. One is a lower aquifer well that's been there for years.
Okay.
And then there is an upper aquifer well that was drilled in 2008, the subject of a previous action. I think it's been included in the staff report. So two wells, both existing.
Both.
One is newer.
Okay.
The way things move in Los Osos, that's pretty new.
I think you get the award for the most humorous presentation today. Okay, that clarifies that mystery for me. I wanted to talk about brine for a minute. And is it hazardous? And where is the brine disposed of? Mm-hmm. Is that backwash or what are we doing here?
Yeah, as part of the operation of the nitrate removal system, there is a backwash cycle and a brine that's generated, a salty brine, similar to what you might see in other water softener type applications. Really, it's a large water softener.
Huge, yeah,
with a special resin that likes nitrate.
Where does the brine backwash go?
There's a number of local facilities, wastewater facilities, that can accept brine. Morro Bay, there's one in South San Luis Obispo County. Pretty much any wastewater facility with an ocean outfall, it's a non-hazardous brine, it's just salty, constituents similar to seawater or even more dilute.
So it's disposed of in the ocean,
yeah,
essentially.
Basically.
Okay, and that brine tank, is that where the backwash goes until it's hauled away?
Correct.
Okay, and then the active ingredient for the water softener or nitrate removal system. Is that involve chlorine or what are we? Is there any hazardous at all?
No, sodium chloride.
It's just salt. Okay.
Yeah, just salt.
Okay. And then I wondered if, I guess this question is for Ms. Brown or Mr. Orton, if there needed to be a finding that the nitrate removal system will indeed result in water that meets state requirements.
I don't believe there needs to be a finding to that effect.
Okay. Let's see, that question got answered. That one got answered. I think, maybe. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Miller. Is there any more discussion, any more questions from commissioners? Not Commissioner Christensen, okay. Then Commissioner Topping, I imagine you're prepared to make a motion.
Yeah, I am. I'd like to make a motion for the following recommended action and also mention that in the process that having been in the water business and CSD business at one point in my career, I appreciate what the district is confronted with here, and you have my full sympathy and support going forward. And good luck on the grant. As the commissioner for the second district, I'd like to recommend that we consider and rely on the previously approved mitigated negative declaration adopted on June 8, 2012, prepared by the Los Osos Community Services District acting as lead agency, and to approve the development plan DRC
2012-00003, Ted Banch, project manager, all supervisorial districts.
Good morning, Mr. Banch, Mr. Lilly. Good morning.
Good morning, Dana Lilly with your planning staff. Well, Mr. Bench finds and loads his PowerPoint.
Sorry.
Keep looking. I'll talk.
Did you guys rehearse this?
This is our comedy routine. So back in 2008, the county adopted an inclusionary housing ordinance, somewhat complicated ordinance in that we endeavored to provide as much flexibility for the applicants as possible. And it's no surprise that as we began implementing it, even though there wasn't a lot of development happening, we found some things that needed to be fixed. Some things were not practical, and that's mostly why we're here today. Find it?
I am not finding it, and I'm about to just bring it. I'm going to do that.
Is it on your flash drive?
It's on my flash drive.
Yeah, we're having some technical difficulties momentarily, but they will be resolved shortly.
There's a bit of commission business we need to take care of as well, and we're coming up on break time, and so I think this is a fine time to take our break. So let's take a 15-minute break until 10:20. This hearing is in recess. Their PowerPoint program, I think. So I think it was momentarily absent without leave, but I think you've found it at this point. Very good.
Thank you. Good morning.
Hi,
I'm
Mr.
Andrew O'Grady and the commission. Again, I want to thank my supervisor, Dana Lilly, for finding my PowerPoint. my item is just calling a cleanup package to the existing inclusionary housing ordinance. The ordinance itself was adopted by the county at the end of 2008, but even at that time, both the public and staff found things that could be done to make the ordinance better, and the board, a few months later, in March of 2009, the Board of Supervisors asked the staff to do a amendment package, and that's what's before us today. This package would do, I'm going to sort of hit like a rock over pond water, just hit the highlights here. What this package would do is it would make clear that density bonus units are allowed even where a project might have more units than what the zoning would normally allow. That was always the intent of the ordinance. And so language has been added both to the land use ordinance, coastal zone land use ordinance, and the framework that clarifies that particular benefit. But I do have to add that in order to get the benefit of bonus units, the developer must meet all of the design standards that are in the inclusionary housing ordinance, and he must clearly be building bonus units because of the inclusionary housing ordinance. You can't get bonus units for other reasons. Other changes would be that the ordinance would add some exemptions. It would exempt vacant lots that are created by subdivisions in the multifamily zone or non-residential zone. And the reason for that is, say in a commercial zone, when we get a subdivision, we don't know what the ultimate use of that vacant lot will be. So the ordinance can be applied once actual construction proposals come forward and a fee can be calculated. Another exemption would be for condominium conversions that do not add new units or add on more floor area. These would be exempt from the inclusionary housing ordinance as well. Mobile home parks would be exempt, and that's because typically a planning department website, but I did not include them in the staff report. I have hard copies available if the public or the commission wants to see them. And I put copies out on the desk outside the chamber doors. Then the regarding the EIR addendum that covers this cleanup package, there is a finding, the first finding, I'm sorry, I don't know exactly which page, I believe it's page 3-5. At the top of the page 3-5 is a finding for regarding the EIR and the EIR addendum, and county council has some wording changes to that finding that they're recommending, and staff concurs with the findings, or I'm sorry, with the rewording of the finding. And I trust the commission has the handout that shows those changes to that finding. Okay. So, in summary, staff would like the commission to consider recommending to the Board of Supervisors that the board certify the final EIR addendum, and also that the board adopt the attached amendment package to the inclusionary housing ordinance. And that concludes my presentation.
Commissioner Christensen.
Yes. Yes, I just had a couple questions before we go to public comment, a couple of them really tiny and then a bigger one. The first one has to do with page 3-11 and the phase-in chart. What year are we in? I just was curious.
2012.
No.
I'm sorry.
You're a regular entertainer today.
Today, it's okay, one
are
of
we,
those days.
Are we in year five yet, or are we still in year four? Because it just says, I just was wondering.
We are in year one.
We're in year one. Why are we in year one?
Because of, done in because of the recession and the building industry being on the ropes, so to speak, each year staff has recommended and the Board of Supervisors has agreed not to move to phase two yet.
Okay. Well, that's kind of disappointing. But, okay, I certainly understand why. And then on page 3-23, it looks like is section 4 has basically completely been deleted. Is that right?
That's correct. That is the definition section.
Right. So does that renumber the sections? I just was out of curiosity. Was wondering.
Yeah, it's being moved to the back.
I know where it's being moved, but I was just wondering if it, because you're taking out section 4 completely, are we, does on the ordinance?
On page 3-25, you find those definitions again, and you'll find where they've been relocated to.
Right, but
that would be the new section 4?
I'm just trying to figure out. I didn't go back and look at the full, like, unmarked up ordinance. So is section 4, now does section 5 now become section 4? I mean, do you renumber the sections because you're taking out a whole section?
Well, I'm taking out a whole section. The definition section is being moved to another location.
Right, so, right.
In this package here, section 4 is the old definitions being struck out entirely. And section 5 is where those definitions went to. Which is the back of the Coastal Zone Land Use Ordinance and the Land Use Ordinance.
Perhaps I can help with that.
Yeah, I'm not asking that question. I don't care where it went. I want to know.
That Section 4 is a Section 4 of the ordinance that's in your exhibit that's amending the Inclusionary Housing Ordinance.
Right.
So the purpose of Section 4 is to show what is being struck.
Okay.
So there is no section 4 in the actual inclusionary housing ordinance.
Okay. That's what I wanted to know. I wanted you to save me a little research time. So
is there a section 5 and section 22.12.080 of the land use ordinance, Title 22? Because if there are any sections after section 4 that's being deleted, they'd have to be renumbered. So I think that was Commissioner Christensen's thrust of her question. So just a reminder that that there might need to be some renumbering happen in the land use ordinance section 2212. Okay.
All right, and one more question. And this is kind of the big question I had is I'm looking at the exemptions, and I see that rental housing is exempted and condominium conversion is exempted. So is there anything to keep somebody from building rental housing and then converting it to condos and then thereby avoiding the entire inclusionary housing ordinance altogether?
What, and Dana can chime in, across the state of California, there have been different cases that have gone to court which make it clear that the local government cannot require affordable rental units as a part of its inclusionary housing ordinance. It can when there's public benefits.
And we're proposing to exempt from that apartments and condominium conversions, and mobile home parks, actually.
Right.
In a different part of the land use ordinance, there's a condo conversion ordinance that will still apply. And we do.
That does not refer back to the inclusionary housing ordinance. It stands on its own.
Yeah, and we don't call it inclusionary. We just say as a condition of converting to condominiums, you must provide affordable housing. We don't think there's a conflict.
So I
it's not obvious to
me. It's not obvious to me.
Observer.
And I've seen it done in San Luis, so that's why I'm...
If I may add in a little bit, over on page 3-9, you'll see under exemptions B, rental housing. And rental housing is proposed to be exempt from the inclusionary housing ordinance. And it's for the reason Dana stated, is that we have another section of our land use ordinance that talks about condominium conversions. If a rental project is converted to condominiums, at that point, 25% of the units have to be affordable to lower moderate income. So there's no reason for a rental project to apply the inclusionary housing ordinance now. Rental units are considered affordable by nature, at least more affordable.
I'm not worried about the rental part. I'm not worried about the rent. If a developer comes in and builds new rental units, I'm fine with that being excluded from inclusionary housing. What I'm concerned about is if a developer comes in, builds rental units, but in the future is intending to convert them into condominiums. And then you have a section here that says conversions are of an existing structure is also exempt, then it looks like you can get around it. So tell me how that doesn't happen.
Can staff try one more time?
Yes.
This exemption would be for the sections of the ordinance that we call the inclusionary housing ordinance. It's not an exemption from the other part of the ordinance, the other part of Title 22 that is the condominium conversion ordinance.
I did understand when you said that the first time. However, couldn't we put a reference to that ordinance that maybe simply says there may be other related requirements in section such and such of this other ordinance? In other words, give people a chance to understand that there is not really a conflict and that this says it's exempt from inclusionary housing. However, you better go over to this other ordinance and take a look at what the requirements are there. Does that help, Commissioner Christensen, if we did that?
Yeah, I don't understand why.
Could I jump
says
in?
It.
Sorry.
You forget it.
This is Whitney McDonald from the County Council's office. And Commissioner Christensen raises a really good point. And I don't think there's any harm in cross-referencing the other provisions of our land use ordinance that would otherwise apply. So perhaps we could add a clause to that. I believe it's at the top of 3-10, little I there.
Yeah.
That's where the exemption exists. And so maybe we could just say at the end there, so long as the project otherwise complies with, and I don't know what section of our ordinance the condo conversion section is in, but maybe we could cross-reference it there. And I think that would take care of your concern, right?
Yeah.
Or are you concerned that maybe our condo conversion ordinance doesn't provide for the same level of...
Well, I don't know what our condo conversion ordinance is. I just know that that the strategy of building rental units and then converting them to condos has been used in San Luis Obispo City as a way of getting around inclusionary housing. Not a terribly horrible, evil way, but it has been used, and I just was surprised to see this. So if you guys all tell me that for whatever reason this exemption would not apply to somebody converting rental units to condos, they would still have to include affordable housing, fine. I'll believe you. But I think, you might want to make it clear.
Could I suggest one possible clause?
Sure.
At the end of, on the exemption B where it says rental housing, to put in a parenthetical statement saying, but conversion of rental apartments to condominiums is subject to section 2208080, condominium conversion.
Yeah, well, I think that helps, but that still leaves I standing out there all by itself, and it just...
If it says rental housing, so if you build houses, for, I mean, I don't know if anybody ever builds houses for rent, but I just don't. I mean, I don't want to belay this and make you guys like wonder what has gone into my brain, but I don't understand how it can say that rental housing is exempt.
Speaks to residential development of two or more units, commercial and industrial development, mixed-use development, and subdivision of land. The reason probably we had it in there is some people might consider subdivision of land a condominium conversion. But if it isn't, then we could take that I out of there.
If that sounds like that's the most direct solution.
You guys want to think about that before we go forward?
I think it makes it less explicit, though, because you have to do some amount of research and legal determination of whether or not a condo conversion is a subdivision or a residential development.
Okay, here's what we're going to do. We'll have a number of other questions from commissioners after for public comment, and y'all can be thinking about how to best address this problem. And so I would like to move to public comment at this time. I'm sorry. Yeah, exactly. I do have one speaker slip. So I'll open public comment on this item now and invite Jerry Bunin to the podium. I won't go over the rules of public testimony, since I know Mr. Bunin is very familiar with them. So good morning, Mr. Bunin.
Thank you, and I'll take less than 3 minutes. Jerry Bunin, Government Affairs Director, Home Builders Association. We support the staff recommendation as part of preparing for this hearing and for the annual review. I went back and reread the ordinance. I would not say that we're advocates for inclusionary housing ordinances, but this is a really good ordinance, and it is the one that when I talk to other government agencies that are thinking about doing this, we always say, well, this is the way you should do it, because this is actually going to be something that will help homes get built. So I'm here doing the shocking thing of saying something nice about the county, saying something nice about the inclusionary ordinance, and supporting the staff recommendation, and I'm done in 50 seconds. Thank you.
I'm sure staff much appreciates your comments, Mr. Bunin. Okay, as I said, that was the only speaker slip that I have. If anyone else desires to speak a public comment on this item, please come forward. Seeing no one, I will close public comment and bring this item back to the commission for discussion consideration. This particular item affects all of the supervisorial districts, so I see Commissioner Topping has his light on. So, Commissioner Topping?
Yeah, just a quick question on definitions. I noticed that affordable housing is defined with a cross-reference to Section 2212-70, Housing Affordability Standards, as, let's see, and also there's a similar reference in Inclusionary Housing Unit to Affordability Standards. The table, which is in the ordinance that shows percentages, I'm wondering, would it be helpful to also include with that table a cross-reference to affordability standards, so when people look at that table, it's on 3-11, C1, inclusionary housing by income group. Wondering if a cross-reference...
It changes, though.
What?
Well,
workforce housing is workforse housing.
And you're talking about what's affordable versus what's not?
No. I'm just talking about those categories that are there on the left-hand column in that table. And so if a builder wants to know, he hadn't read the rest of the ordinance, just wants to know what that means, a simple cross-reference to Section 22.12.70,
oh,
housing affordability standards. This is a question similar to what I asked when we had the economic element here, because it's not. People don't automatically in their minds attach. They should do their homework, but they don't necessarily attach meaning to those terms.
Commissioner Topping, if I may, the definition for affordable housing certainly has to refer to the section that defines low and moderate income and low and moderate housing.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right,
sure. Make this as user-friendly as possible.
Okay.
Anything else, Commissioner Topping?
That's it.
Okay. No one else has their microphone lights on, so I'll ask my questions. On staff report page 3-1, Mr. Bench, you spoke about overriding considerations earlier. Was there anything... Well, presumably there wasn't anything that would cause changes to the overriding considerations or additional overriding considerations as you went through and prepared these amendments.
Chairman O'Grady, that's correct.
Okay. Okay, on page 3-2 of the staff report, you also mentioned the density bonus provisions in your presentation, and said they would even apply where it made the density greater than the zoning would otherwise allow in a given area. So some might look at that as compromising the zoning and the reasons for the zoning. So how, when you're evaluating a particular project with that scenario, how will you determine whether the zoning would be compromised to the point where the project should not be approved? I mean, what's the yardstick for that, or is there one?
Chairman O'Grady. I'd like to point to on page 3-16, G1, which talks about density bonus unit. It specifically says here that a project can have bonus units even where it would exceed the zoning and the base density.
Thank you, Mr. Batch. I think that addresses my. So there's that's where the yardstick is, the judgment.
There is an escape valve.
Got it. Okay. Wonderful. Thank you. And then also on page 3-2, the vacant lot business. It says exempts commercial, bless you, and industrial subdivisions that create vacant lots, and the reason being it's difficult to apply inclusionary housing ordinance provisions until future development is proposed on these lots and fees can be calculated. So it's not as if all current and future projects would be exempt. So the wording in the ordinance couldn't be misinterpreted as saying, well, okay, we did this project earlier and it created a vacant lot and it's exempt from our future development. That's not the case. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. All right. On page 3-3, Public Works had some comments.
But it looked, I made a note that the, there, the Public Works comment with reference to H6A was not incorporated,
it
and was. I wondered
it
what.
Was, it actually was.
Oh, it was?
I went and looked at the actual language, and they included that, too.
Oh, they did. Yeah. Okay, very good.
It had to do with getting a recent appraisal as opposed to just appraisal, and they did include the word recent.
Oh, okay.
So I don't know why they didn't. I had to make sure, Glenn.
We're looking out for your interest, yeah. Okay. And then also on page 3-3, just in the next paragraph, it says, NCSD and the county have an ongoing discussion regarding how section 22.12.080K2 is worded, and I just made a note to discuss, and I can't recall off the top of my head. Maybe you gentlemen know off the tops of your heads what that's all about.
The Nipomo groundwater basin is under some stress, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
So the district was concerned about any density bonuses that the county would approve that could conceivably require additional water use. And so they filed a legal complaint.
Hello, Ms. McDonald. What's that all about?
So Mr. Lilly is correct that there was a lawsuit filed over the inclusionary housing ordinance when it was first enacted. That lawsuit has not been resolved.
Presumably there's some evidence or citation for that. Can you tell us what where that evidence
came
from?
Sure. There's a number of ways of doing it, but the one that we probably reference the most is there's a National Association of Home Builders and Wells Fargo Bank publish a affordable housing index, and one component of it is what percent of the local households can afford the median-priced home. And so that's one gauge, and we're consistently
Is that county-specific?
It's county-specific.
Okay.
So we are one of the housing markets, and we're consistently one of the least affordable.
Okay, and then number three says local businesses have left the county, closed, or failed to expand because of the lack of high-quality employees. That comes from the Chamber of Commerce, perhaps, or
we have heard from businesses who have told us that. We've also been aware of specific businesses in the past that have left.
Okay. I think on the recently issued county newsletter, planning department newsletter, I think it was, that the FTHB has a home loan program where $60,000, maximum of $60,000, it can be borrowed from the county at 3% interest. And apparently there's $1 million budgeted and available for presumably lower income folks. How does that dovetail with these ordinance, with the affordable housing ordinance amendments that we're talking about here?
I'll take a stab at that. National studies of inclusionary housing ordinances have told us that jurisdictions cannot rely on an inclusionary housing ordinance to produce all your affordable housing. May seem obvious, but at least they've done studies to support that, and they say there are a variety of other ways and strategies that local governments use when they need more affordable housing than is naturally occurring, and finding funding programs is one of those tools. And so we got $1 million grant from the state to do that.
So it's sort of a companion thing.
Yes.
Then. Okay. Now, I do have a few questions on the language of the ordinances, but if another commissioner would like to jump in at this point and ask any questions. Okay, then I'll just go through mine. On page 3-9, under exemptions, 2A says, development that is non-residential or non-commercial in nature, such as educational facilities, schools, museums, religious institutions, public facilities, public infrastructure. Where do nonprofit organizations fit into this? And some other ordinances that we've dealt with, we've kind of singled out nonprofit organizations for some special treatment. And, you know, some educational facilities are for-profit, some are non-profit. In other words, some commercial establishments are for-profit and some are non-profit. Is that relevant, or should it be, as far as exemptions are concerned?
I would have to, my first response is that we'll surely see this come up time and again. Different nonprofits would like to be exempt from the inclusionary housing ordinance. We don't get very many nonprofits that actually build office buildings so this question has not come up very often. But ultimately, the planning department can make an interpretation of whether a project would meet this requirement, and that interpretation can be appealed to your commission.
Okay. This is just a kind of the spur of the moment question. I realize you haven't had time to consider it. So, Ramona, I would like the minutes to show that I'd like this question brought before the supervisors about the relevance of nonprofits and perhaps exemptions might be appropriate in certain cases for nonprofits.
Well, maybe not.
Right. That's my personal opinion. I'm not saying this is from the board. This is just Dan O'Grady.
Yeah.
That be a factor in judging whether or not.
Maybe just,
Let's see. On page 3-12 of the staff report, it's item 5.5, there's a reference to section D2, but I thought maybe it should be C1, or maybe also C1. D2 is on 330. And then on D1, I think it's D1, let's see. Oh, they're talking about prime agricultural soil. And my question was, what if market rate units are on prime soil? What happens then, or proposed to be on prime soil?
So where are you again?
I'm just below D1 on page 3-13 of the staff report. Is there another ordinance that talks about the market rate units on prime soil? Because this, we were talking about, this prohibits, as I understand it, from building inclusionary housing units on prime ag soil. Is that what that does?
Chairman O'Grady, a little background there. The final environmental impact report that reviewed this ordinance realized that an applicant could propose bonus units anywhere in the county, even in the ag zone. But the EIR said that's okay, but do not allow that new units, bonus units, to go on prime ag soil. And that's how this wording got.
So presumably that would apply to market rate units. So, well, you're not discriminating against inclusionary units, right?
At least because the EIR was covering the inclusionary housing ordinance, it wanted to be sure that no units that came from this ordinance were on prime ag soil.
All right, I see the point you're making. Back up to E again. It says, inclusionary housing requirement of this section shall be applied only to the actual number of market rate units approved. And my question was, is the base density the number of market rate units? Is that what that?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
So what this section is saying is that the inclusionary ordinance is only applied to the actual number of units in the project, not the maximum number of units that project could have.
Okay. On page 3-14, in several paragraphs, it talks about payment, when the fee payments are supposed to be made. Okay. And I'm thinking there's some conflicts in these three areas. And paragraph 2, it says fee payment may be deferred until final permit approval for occupancy. Okay. But then down in number three, it says when the applicant proposes to pay the fees, okay, then the fee schedule will be determined. And then in 3C, it says, well, if the subdivider defers fee payment until the occupancy or sale of the parcel or unit. And I think those are three different things. And I didn't think that you were intending. I thought you were intending that we're talking about the same timetable for paying the fee.
I can speak to the first one up on number two. The new language, there is a typo in there. Fee payment may be deferred until final permit approval or occupancy. Should be or instead of for.
So until the folks actually move into the unit, they don't have to pay?
Either before you move into the unit or before final permit approval, the fee must be paid.
Well, fee payment may be deferred until final permit approval or occupancy, I understood you to say. Okay. So occupancy is after final permit approval, so an applicant would most likely defer payment until folks moved in. And I just wanted to make sure that that's what you're intending.
I think I see Chairman O'Grady kind of looking my way. I think that this doesn't actually really change much. People already had an opportunity to pay either when they pulled a permit or when they got final occupancy or final sign-off. So I think this language here is really just a clarification to make it clear that you have either option, and it depends on the builder and what's going on with their individual project. Sometimes they, I think, want to pay the fees up front and sometimes want to defer until the unit basically is sold.
Okay, so what is the language just as it's written or what Mr. Bench has said?
Could you repeat that?
Yeah, I think in response to my question, you proposed some different language in paragraph two.
Are you talking about occupancy being the certificate of occupancy issued, or are you talking about somebody physically moving in the house?
The intent is that the unit, the fee may be deferred let's back up a second. So
can we take a break here? Not a break for the commission. If we could move on, staff wants to consult a little bit on this point, and we'll revisit it later.
Okay. May I continue with my questions? On 4, on page 3-14, it says a mixed-use project shall have at least 25% of its total floor area designated for habitable residential use. Where did that 25% come from?
Where did the 25% come from?
Yes. Seems like a magic number or something. I just wanted
it was a number that was agreed to during the public hearing process when the original ordinance was approved.
Okay. So we're going to revisit then Commissioner Murphy's question about occupancy or a permit occupancy. On page 3-19, I, eligible residences, and I-2 says the county or other organization designated by the county shall verify the household income of prospective, we're getting rid of the word renters, and we're adding occupants or buyers. And I'm trying to understand. I understand why you want to verify the income of buyers, in other words, owners of the premises. But why would occupants be in there? I mean, if a parent buys a house for their kids, is it relevant? And the kids are going to live in it. Is it
do you really, it is, you want it relevant to what the income of the children are who are going to be living in the houses? Is that, or am I totally misunderstanding this language?
If I may, I'm reading it as we speak. So the intent is that this section is to explain who can occupy the inclusionary unit that's created by this ordinance. And one of the tests, of course, will be the income test. If it's for a low-income unit, then you need to verify the income of the household that it is, in fact, a low-income household that's moving into that unit. The county has relied on nonprofit agencies that have training in doing income verification, such as People's Self-Help and the Housing Authority of San Luis Obispo. They do income verification, of course, because before someone moves into a rental unit occupied by the or owned by the housing authority, there must be proof that they are a low-income household.
Yeah, well, the housing authority, well, the organization that's or the individual that is purchasing the unit, I mean, that could be a private individual, as I mentioned, buying a home for their children or relatives or whoever, or it could be an organization such as Habitat for Humanity or something like that. So presumably the income verification requirements would not apply to organizations, even though they're the buyers. And then secondly, wouldn't you want to encourage folks that have the wherewithal to purchase low-income housing, expanding the supply of the low-income housing, in other words, to house low-income people?
I think I can help.
Okay.
It's our understanding that inclusionary housing ordinances need to allow the developer to satisfy it either by providing the ownership housing or by providing rental housing. Now, while we're saying in the ordinance we want to exempt new rental developments, if a builder is building ownership housing and inclusionary housing applies and wants to provide a few rental units to satisfy the inclusionary units, they can do so. In that case, it would be occupants. We struck renter and put occupants because there's a variety of types of people who would be in those units. And the whole public purpose is it's affordable to whoever is going to be living in those. So we want to know that they are in one of these income groups.
But if you put buyer down there, no matter who then occupies the unit, they may very well be low-income people. But if the buyer are now to be buyers and occupants, or they can't buy the place and they're just going to occupy it, and they would meet the household income test, so presumably they could live there. But if you put buyers in, they wouldn't be able to live there by virtue of the generosity of the buyer who might not meet the household income test. So that's my point. And so I'm wondering about the necessity of including the word buyer, because it's the folks that are going to, the occupants is what the inclusionary housing is focused on. I mean, maybe they win in the lottery. I don't know, but so I mean, so.
But isn't the purpose to make sure that if there is a buyer that's in an owner-occupied unit, that they meet the maximum income test? Isn't that the whole point?
Not a buyer. It's the occupant. It's the occupant.
Well, yeah, they're an occupant, too.
Well sure. If they're an occupant, then you don't need the word buyer.
Well, but there could be just a buyer. The occupant part refers to the rental situation, and the buyer part refers to a buyer who's low income. That's how it works. Yeah, I mean, I it's true a millionaire could come along and say, I want to buy low-income housing and let poor people live here. That they're the ones that they're called developers, and they're building it in the first place. Yeah, we're not taking out the word buyers.
Well, I think that's silly, frankly. And what I'm saying is that there's an opportunity here that you're just dismissing for no reason.
And so I'm just asking staff, why is the need to include the word buyers here?
And staff would say probably technically you are correct that we could just have occupants and it would apply. Part of our concern is, will one of our staff or maybe an applicant read this later and not realize that owner-occupied housing is okay? I think you're fine by making the change.
Okay. Mr. Bunin raised his hand, and I am interested in his input on this housing-related item. You're welcome.
Jerry Bunin, Government Affairs Director, Home Builders Association. I do not believe that the scenario you describe mm-hmm. would qualify a buyer. I can't buy an inclusionary home if I don't qualify for it and then let somebody else live there. The buyer is going to be an affordable, they're going to be a low-income family, and they're going to buy it to live there, not to rent it to somebody else.
So you say that, but what law prevents you from?
Your ordinance prevents that. It is
well, this is what I'm addressing.
The ordinance does not allow somebody who's a millionaire or a middle-income family to go buy an inclusionary home. They have to be income qualified to buy the home.
Even if they're not occupying it.
I believe they have to occupy the home. You have to own it for an extended period of time before you sell it. And then when you sell it, you have to sell it to another low-income family. You don't even get to reap the reward of equity under the inclusionary program. It has to stay in a low-income family. I think you're misreading. You're thinking that somebody's going to come in and provide this to somebody else. You either are low-income and you rent it, or you are low-income and you buy it. And you have to be income-qualified to buy it. If I buy it today because I'm low income and tomorrow I win the lottery, I still get to own that home because I was low income when I qualified and bought it.
Okay, well, I do understand what you're saying, and I just wanted to have this conversation because I think under certain circumstances it could discourage otherwise occupiable inclusionary housing. So.
We're going to have a really good discussion sometime about how you could fix problems like that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bunin. Okay, moving on. Okay, question on 3-21. And I read about when inclusionary housing needed to be built on phased projects. And I guess I got a little confused about it, so I came up to a question. This is page 3-21 on five. Well, I think maybe 5A3. It talks about phasing of project development, and so my question is: can all inclusionary housing be deferred to the final phase?
Chairman O'Grady.
582.
The section.
Page 3-25. Section 5. This is all new, added. All of this. All of these definitions are added to the. Okay.
That's
all new stuff.
There is one addition, which is the map you see on page 3-26 that was not in the definition before.
Right.
Housing market areas was in the definition. Now you have a map to go with it.
Okay. On page 3-27, we talk about inclusionary housing agreement, inclusionary housing unit, but we don't just talk about inclusionary housing, and yet the amendment is replete with the words inclusionary housing, and yet you're differentiating between an agreement and a unit. So I just thought there might be a need for a definition for just inclusionary housing, but I'll leave that up to Ms. McDonald, County Council, to make that determination. And then also on page 3-28, we in Section 7, we talk about near-market value units. Well, there was a market rate unit definition, and but there's no near market value unit. definition. So I'm thinking there's three things here: market rate unit, or to, and a near market value unit. So it sounds like we need to.
They're actually intended to mean slightly different things.
Okay.
So market rate just means it's not restricted in price.
Okay.
Whereas market value means there's an appraisal telling us what the value of that unit is.
Okay.
And in this case, if the value is, I think, comparable or below what our affordable price would be for the unit, we don't need to deed restrict them.
Okay, so do you want to add that definition then for a near market value unit?
We kind of thought it was described in the text of the paragraph.
Okay, and so the text of the paragraph does indeed apply to a near market value unit and not to near market rate unit. Okay. All right?
Yep.
Okay, and then I got to Title 23, and I just wondered, what are the key differences? I didn't plow through Title 23 like I did Title 22, I have to confess, but I just wondered if what I did look at in Title 23 looked pretty similar in the places I checked. Are there some key differences that we should be aware of that you might want to mention?
Between the inclusionary ordinance in Title 22 and 23?
Yes.
The key differences come from the Coastal Commission, actually. The one key difference is that the Coastal Commission had us add another section, 230497, which made it clear that bonus units could be added to a project only where you're inside of an urban reserve line and you're not interfering or impacting any of the coastal resources that are named in that section.
That's not a change proposed today. That was part of the originally adopted ordinance. The Coastal Commission doesn't want any bonuses outside of urban reserves.
Okay, but as far as the changes we're dealing with, you've tried to reflect all the changes the same way in both titles. Okay, well, those are my questions. Commissioner Topping, your light is on.
Yeah, with regard to the... to the housing market area map, I think that pretty well defines the boundaries within which these provisions could apply, not necessarily have to apply in the sense that, for example, in the case of the prime agricultural soil, if you've got California Valley there, I would think that much of California Valley is prime agricultural soil from our experience with the sun power and solar plants. Are they not? I'm just thinking of, is there a catch in that prime agricultural soil statement that basically narrows you down to a smaller area than what's shown on your housing market area map?
Commissioner Topping, there's no catch, if you will.
It would be based on sites. You may have prime agricultural soil within some of those areas, and if not...
Well, we're not ready yet. We got two places. My condo... I agree with you that this is great. I understand it all. I just had the one thing about the condo conversion, and then you guys wanted to go and revisit yourself the thing on the timing of the fee payment.
That's correct.
So, yeah. I'm on the condo conversion language, if you have a suggestion, great. I believe you that somebody couldn't really do that, but it's not what it actually says, so I just wanted to make sure that it really does say that, and that really is no ability to convert rental units that were built with an exclusion and also have them excluded, the condos excluded. Doesn't seem right. So what have you guys decided?
So on that one, the suggested language I had offered before, uh-huh. I was really offering it in the wrong place, I
okay.
think, is to offer it at the end of that, on page 310, that little I, where it's an exemption for condominium conversions, but at the end of that to say, but condominium conversions are still subject to, and then insert the proper code for where that is in Title 22 and 23.
All right.
Sure.
Sounds good to me. That works.
Do we need to add that to J as well?
I believe so.
Or is it really more of a concern about residential conversions?
It's a residential.
Right. It really is a residential thing because you don't build rental housing of, you don't build commercials aren't rental housing. And you do also would want to change the language on the corresponding section in Title 23.
Correct. Thank you.
So, which is somewhere in here. Is that little XI on IX on page 3-37.
Okay.
That's good. I agree.
And there was another issue
that was hanging. Your microphone, please.
The other issue that was hanging up, we just consulted, and if I can remember where that was, with the page 3-14. Okay. The way he has this already is correct because where am I?
Section 2, so this fee payment, the one that's underlined fee payment, may be deferred until final permit approval. Should it remain for occupancy?
For occupancy. We do not have a certificate of occupancy. So our equivalent is the final permit, which authorizes occupancy. So we have a hook on them to say, okay, you have to pay us if you want us to final your building permit.
Okay, so it is for occupancy.
Yes.
Should we add
or sale, as we've done on 3C, to make the match?
If I could chime in for a second.
That's another reason, another precondition before they can sell is they have to have our permit final before they can sell it. So it would operate that way anyway.
So no, don't add anything or change anything is what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
All right.
On 2, how about, you said something about C has to add it?
Well, 3C, because when I had the conversation with Mr. Bench earlier, he was saying the language in 3C ought to match the language in 2.
And
but so not so is that true or false?
Thank you for giving me a chance to respond.
Sure.
Chairman O'Grady, I would leave 2 or at the top of the page, I'd leave number 2 alone as okay. Dana Lilly just mentioned. I wanted to point out that number 3C is dealing with condominium subdivisions, and the subdivider may, if it was a condominium, the subdivider may want to defer the fee either until the unit is ready for occupancy, it has its certificate of occupancy, or until he sells the unit to somebody, even if it's not completely finished yet.
It's different.
Or I suppose it's even as so flexible as for a condominium, brand new condominium project, that somebody could finish it, have it ready for occupancy, but he's got a whole condominium project standing vacant, and he would like to defer until he actually sells the unit. And this would allow him to do that.
But up front, payment of housing impact fee. Are we saying that's just it says fee payment may be deferred only until final permit approval for occupancy. So which
housing?
Yeah. Well, I was just I'm just raising the question that we use inclusionary housing language probably more than we talk about inclusionary housing agreement or inclusionary housing unit. So, but I mean, if Ms. McDonald thinks those two things cover it, hey.
It's fine with me, but...
We're flexible. I mean...
Well, I'll leave that. I have no... I'm just raising the question and leaving up to the ordinance writer. That's you. So I was just looking for it, and I didn't see it, because I thought agreement and unit meant different things than the broader inclusionary housing. But okay, I guess we're going to leave that out. So the only changes were on pages, 3-10?
3-11.
Just 3-11.
Cross-reference.
On the
footnote.
In the findings.
Footnote, the findings, and then the corresponding page is like 3-37 and Title 23. Is there also a corresponding
3-10,
page
37.
In Title 23?
For the condo conversion thing? Exemption?
Yeah.
3-37.
Right, but also for Commissioner Topping's
the
chart
footnote?
On page 3-11. Is there another chart in
it is
somewhere? Yeah, there is. 338, maybe? Needs the footnote?
It's, yeah, 3-38,
yes.
Yeah.
Okay, hopefully the record is clear with all of that. So, can anyone think of any other questions they'd like to ask or any concerns? Okay, well, then, Commissioner Christensen, would you like to
sure.
make this motion?
I will go ahead and make a motion that we recommend to the Board of Supervisors that they approve the Environmental Impact Report Addendum in accordance with the applicable provisions of the California Environmental Quality Act, Public Resources Code Section 21,000XX. And approve the amendments to the Land Use Ordinance, the Coastal Zone Land Use Ordinance, and the framework for planning as shown in Exhibits LRP 2006-00003, A, B, C, and D, based on the recommended findings as amended, and the statement of overriding consideration that are attached to this staff report. And the language as amended.
Very good. May I have a second?
Second.
And I understand there's no further discussion, so Ramona, please call the roll.
Commissioner Christensen?
Aye.
Commissioner Topping?
Yes.
Commissioner Murphy?
Yes.
Chairman O'Grady?
Yes. Motion passes 4-0. Mr. Bench and Mr. Lilly, thank you for a fine job. Really appreciate it. And so we've made good progress this morning where we don't have to come back this afternoon, actually. And thank you for the public comment, Mr. Bunin. Appreciate that. Oh, well, that's very important. Can we get that in the minutes? No, I'm just kidding. Okay, just a couple other pieces of business. I need a motion to take all testimony and documents into the record.
So moved.
Second. Please.
Second.
Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? None. Motion passes 4-0. And lastly, I need a motion to adjourn this meeting till the next meeting on October 25th, 2012.
So moved.
Second.
And second. Thank you, Mr. Murphy. All in favor?
Yes.
Aye. Any opposed? None. Motion passes 4-0. Thanks, everybody. Good work.
Yeah.